Call the Capital Investment Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll. I'd like to welcome Commissioner Anguson to the committee. Thank you for being here, and we'll let you start today with Governor Pawlenty's budget, or I mean capital budget recommendations. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to introduce with me is Lee Merkins. He's our capital budget coordinator at the Department of Finance. Also, Mr. Chair, as I understand, your hearing is scheduled till 4 o'clock, or?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And also, Mr. Chairman, I would just plan for this to be somewhat of an overview, knowing that we're prepared to answer some questions about things, but if there are some more detailed questions about particular projects, it might be helpful to kind of get back to you with the specific agencies that have responsibility for the projects.
That's understood.
We'll do what we can.
I just wanted everyone to, I'm wearing my capital investment tie today, so I got that as a birthday present from the governor.
But Mr. Chair, it's
How true, how true. And that's what we're here. We're here to separate the good from the bad cholesterol, yes. So, anyway. So, without further ado.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and members. This is the kind of primary areas that we break down the governor's capital budget recommendations in: the areas of education, economic development, housing, transportation, environment areas, safer communities, effective government, and public service. We try to, I'm just going to talk a little bit in these first few slides, a little bit about the approach that we try to take here in looking through this. Really seeing that this has somewhat of a balanced approach to the capital recommendations that are out there, recognizing the constraints that we have on debt service and the current operating budget deficit. Really looking at the high priority program needs, I think that they're, for the most part, for all of the agencies and entities requesting, that it was the higher priority projects that were recommended by the governor. Also wanted to make some selective strategic investments, balancing the regional and statewide needs, balancing out across the state, and looking at a combination or a balance between preserving the assets that we currently have with funding to repair and maintain existing assets with a combination of some new projects. The overall requests totaled $1.6 billion. As you know, and members of this committee, that's well beyond what is actually our capacity, what we consider to be our debt capacity. Some of the principles that we have thought of over the years and continue to think of here are the regaining our AAA credit rating, really kind of managing with a debt level that has been considered somewhat moderate by the rating agencies, remaining well within the 3% guideline, the debt management guideline that we have, and preserving some capacity for the future, for future bonding projects. And again, also the projects that support the governor's broader policy agenda.
Commissioner, if you could excuse me, if we could go back just to a previous slide. I know that there's quite a bit of confusion surrounding the 3% guideline. Could you just give us a brief explanation of what that 3% guideline is and how that has been, where it comes from and how it has been utilized?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes. We have a number of things that we consider to be kind of guidelines in trying to look at the overall debt, and part of our debt management policy, and this was developed in the 80s as we were looking at trying to kind of manage and look at really provide a little bit of discipline in the capital budget process to look at the relationship between the debt service that's as part of our operating budget and the longer-term outstanding debt. And this guideline says that no more than 3% of the non-dedicated revenue to the general fund will be used as debt service. So we look overall at our total budget, look at the portion that existing debt service covers, what that amount is to pay for the outstanding bonds that are currently outstanding, bonds that are authorized but unissued, and then consider consider overall the capacity. Now, I would say just to quickly remind you that when we're looking at that guideline, we're looking at the projects that are supported by the general fund with debt service. There are some projects in the governor's recommendations, and we'll get to a chart a little bit later that talks about the funding overall, the breakout of the funds. So there are some other dollars other than the general funds that support the debt on these bonds, and I'll point that out, Mr. Chairman, as we get to that a little bit later.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain where the 3% came from? Is that an arbitrary figure picked out of the air, or is there some numerical sense to be made from 3% versus 2% or 4%, or, in my esteemed chair's belief, a lot lower?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think what we looked at the time, I wasn't at the Finance Department at the time that this guideline was developed, but was familiar with the discussion at the time. Actually, it might have even been the later 70s when we were looking at this, and really just kind of looking at where things had been historically and looking at where you obviously the amount of outstanding debt that you have puts pressure on your operating funds, and it's money that can't be spent for other programmatic areas and that sort of thing. So we were really looking historically at where things had been at, and at a couple of times as we looked at the history, the guideline was exceeded, but felt like this was a reasonable amount, and really also kind of looking a little bit at what other states do. And this is considered to be a fairly moderate but reasonable level of debt from the perspective of comparing other states that rating agencies consider.
And just a quick follow-up.
Representative Mahoney.
I know you've got a lot to go through here, but you say sometimes that 3% was exceeded. Was there a reason for that exceeding? Was it a low interest rate or excessive need, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, it was when we looked at developing the policy, we looked historically and at the three, sometimes in the past, before the guideline was adopted, it had exceeded 3%, but felt like this, so it wasn't like set so that we would never, had never in the past reached it. So it had historically, in some cases, exceeded that 3%, but and maybe only once since. But I think it was mostly because it wasn't an intentional the time that it has exceeded since the guideline has been in place. It was more like once we got a final accounting of what the total general fund was, that it was noted that it slightly exceeded the amount.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner, maybe you could tell us currently where we are as a barometer. You have
well,
that figure?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that with me, and I was thinking as we started this discussion, it would be a great thing to be able to tell you.
Mr. Walls, do you know what the... I've seen it recently. I think it's about 2.7.
Mr. Chair, in recent discussions with Peter Salson from the Department of Finance, I believe he told me the current situation was about 2.42% is where we stood, and we were approaching 2.47 with the next bond sale, give or take a hundredth or so of a percent.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that may sound like it would be close. I think what we'd want to be able to do is tell you what it would be under the governor's recommendations, and we'll certainly get back to you with that information.
So, just members, something to be aware of in this discussion, that when that 3% guideline is talked about, that is merely a sort of a historical guideline. It's not a statutory provision. So
that would be a record break, sir?
Some people may look at breaking records, but we'll leave that to the Senate, maybe, Representative Mahoney. So, Commissioner, why don't we continue? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Stolberg has a question.
I'm sorry to come in late, but I also, there's the 3% guideline is a quick and dirty type of guideline that we can calculate quite fast. But actually, don't bond councils and Wall Street look at some of the other issues that are in our budget, such as your debt capacity as a percentage of personal income or some of the other things. And I don't remember what that is, but it's a little bit more difficult to calculate. Maybe you can help refresh our memories, or from my memory anyway, and what are the other standards would be besides just the 3% standard?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, there are actually four measures that are part of our debt management guideline. The 3% is the one that becomes the largest constraint in looking at our budget. Another one is a debt as total overall debt as a percent of personal income. And I'll tell you, I'm not exactly sure of what that number is either. Mr. Chair, I apologize as I'm sitting here thinking that oftentimes Peter Salson is available to kind of give an overview to the committee, and I would certainly offer that just really about the debt management guidelines.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my point is that the 3% is one that we can all wrap our hands around real easy. I mean, it's a one big calculation, pretty easy, but it may not be the most meaningful as well with some of the bond councils. Some of the other ones may be actually a more meaningful restraint.
Members, I think the commissioner has offered that Mr. Salson come, and probably be a good idea for us just to review that information. Some of you may be very familiar with it, others may not be aware of it at all. So we'll schedule to have Mr. Salson come and just go through those debt management issues with us as we embark on the process. Representative Murphy.
Opening remarks, you talked about the higher priority needs and having a balance. Could you define higher priority for me?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, what the governor did in putting his recommendations together is to really look at the priority ranking and orders that each of the agencies or systems requested, and for the most part followed those priorities, and especially the top priorities of all of those. Obviously, with the request being $1.6 billion, it doesn't go down the whole list of priorities, but generally all of the top priorities were recommended by the governor.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, can I assume then that the top priorities are 1 through 5 and not 6, but 7 and 8 are okay?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I have the feeling that you're talking about a very specific recommendation, and I could attempt to address that here if you'd like. And
this is just introductory now, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I'd be reluctant to suggest a certain number because some agencies only had one request. Some had quite a bit, and obviously where, you know, there were more than 5 items on a request, certainly not much below that may have been funded. But I would, if you'd like, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I can maybe speak to the very specific recommendation that you're referring to, as we talked a little at the outset.
Commissioner, Representative Murphy, why don't we let the commissioner go through the basic presentation, and then why don't we come back to your question as to some of the decisions that the governor made in terms of his recommendations. So I think other committee members will have questions specifically to some of the governor's recommendations also. Is that all right with you?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So let's just, we apologize, we've already diverted you from your presentation, so
that's all right.
Let's try to get back to that. Thank you.
Okay, this chart, this slide shows the total recommendations in the governor's capital budget, $760 million. And then as we talked a little bit earlier about our debt management guideline and the financing sources, the total amount that is funded by the general fund, where the debt service of the general obligation bonds are funded by the general fund, it's $689 million. And that's the number that we use when we're trying to look at how we come with that measure of debt capacity using general fund, the 3% general fund debt management guideline.
Mr. Chairman, can I interrupt again?
Excuse us one second. Representative Solar.
I hope this is a pertinent question. And that is, in the governor's recommendation, and how much additional money is does it take this biennium addition from his proposal from last year to have that kind of a bonding bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, the additional debts, maybe I should just kind of go back a little bit to frame your question a little bit in the context, is that currently the forecast that we're operating under, which was our November forecast that was released in December, we put in the budget, the current budget, an estimate of debt service. And we look at the cost of debt service in the operating budget for all of the outstanding debt, the debt that's authorized but not yet issued based on some cash flow estimates of when they'll be issued. And then we reserve some additional debt service in there to kind of cover an expected bonding bill of this session. And we use a number that's like a 10-year average that I'll show you when we get to a chart later to try to say this is kind of the level. So the current budget that's in place has the ability, debt service, to fund $530 million. And that relates to that general fund GO bonding number. So that difference of about $160 million or so from the 689 to the 530 needs some additional debt service. And with the governor's recommendations, the amount that we're looking at for added debt service in this biennium is just under $4 million.
Thank you.
Okay, let's continue then, Commissioner.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, this is a chart that shows you a little bit of history on the capital budgets that you'll see. We've really kind of moved here in the early 90s to a little bit more of we moved in the middle 90s to larger bonding bills and more into the off year, to the even numbered years with bonding bills. You'll see there still is in spite of the even year plan for bonding bills, every year there's been a bonding bill. We generally kind of reserve in our estimates some modest level of funding in the off year to deal with emergencies or urgent items. But you can see here where we've been kind of historically with capital budgets and where the governor's recommendation was currently here. The next page, Mr. Chair and members, shows what we use to get to that number that we include, the assumption that we include in our forecast document. And this is just really looking at those even numbered years since the middle 90s, when we've been mostly moving the capital budget to the even numbered years, and looking at a total dollar amount averaging over that time period. And that's where we use the $530 million, where you see $529 here. And then when we look at all funding sources, the average over this time period is just under $800 million. And that would include that highway funding and user financing and some of the other funding sources that are included in the capital budget recommendations.
Commissioner, is there a particular reason why you've only put up the even years? Are we leaving out some reason why we're leaving out the odd numbered years when we seem to have bonding bills every year?
Mr. Chairman, yes, if you go to the previous chart, you see the every year numbers. And the reason why we were looking at just the even numbered years is that's what we've been basing our forecast assumption on. You know, what in terms of the capacity, as you know, Mr. Chairman, usually the forecast is reflects current law, and we need to make some sort of estimate in the forecast. And rather than pulling some number out of the air, we've been using the average of the even year capital budgets historically for our assumption in the forecast. And so that's why this chart shows the even numbered years, because this is the basis for the assumption that we make in the forecast.
Representative Solberg.
Can I ask, can you go back one? That's the chart. It's hard to read that 03. What was the number that's associated with 03?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, the 03 number, actually, again, this chart includes all funds. There was a bonding bill in the 03 session where the general obligation supported bonding funds were $189 million. The total, this also, this total, it shows $747 million. And that includes the trunk highway bonds that were authorized.
Which was
$510 million of highway bonds were authorized. And that includes some that were, 110 that were previous general fund dollars that were appropriated were refinanced, so additional $110 million over and above the $400 that was new highway bonding authorization.
So, Mr. Chairman, we took 110 out of actually 00 or 02 and put into truck highway fund, if I recall right. And that was general obligation. Then we transferred it to our cash or something. We transferred it to the truck highway, right? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I think it was an even earlier session that authorized appropriated general fund dollars for transportation, and those were the 110 was refinanced last year in bonding, borrowing.
And that was refinanced with GO or truck highway?
Trunk highway bonds.
So that chart is somewhat misleading. There's no obligation from the general fund to pay 03, is there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, the chart is all funds, so I hope you're not misled by that. When we say it's all funds, and it includes that it's $747 million and includes $510 of highway bonds. The GO portion is $189 million.
Mr. Chairman, we never did have a hearing on transportation bonds, and we're paying for those out of the transportation fund savings, evidently, of closing press stops and not following that kind of stuff. But that's an obligation. It would really be helpful, I think, if we were concentrated on the general obligation bonds, because that's what we're going to be concerned about in this. Thank you.
Representative Solberg, I think last time I checked, debt was debt.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the debt is debt, but it doesn't include any relationship to a general obligation debt as opposed to a truck highway debt. I mean, there's two different sources of funds to pay for it. And I don't think there's anything in the truck highway that said that any time that there's a general obligation bond with associated with the truck highway funds. So if there's not the savings in there, the bondholders, I don't think they got the same interest rate even.
Commissioner, what is the ultimate source of revenue for trunk highway bonds?
Mr. Chairman, the trunk highway bonds are repaid by the gas tax and license tab fees. The Trunk Highway Fund pays the debt service on highway bonds.
And if there, for some reason, wasn't a sufficient amount of money in those funds to pay them, how are they then? Is there some other alternative funding mechanism?
Mr. Chairman, those highway bonds are general obligations of the taxpayers and hold the same general obligation pledge that other general fund bonds. It would require a imposition of a statewide property tax to pay if the funds were insufficient. But for the highway fund bonds, the debt service gets first call on any trunk highway revenues. So the first dollar of gas tax collected goes to pay the debt.
Thank you. Let's continue then.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that clarification.
That was the commissioner's clarification.
I think it's important to understand what our bonding capacity is. From a general obligation standpoint, there's some other obligations.
Anyway, Commissioner, let's try to continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members, this is a little bit of a breakdown by some of the areas of the policy areas in the budget of the governor's recommendations. You'll see it's a little over $195 million for education. This includes higher education and a few projects in the education area. Economic development, housing, and transportation at about $194 million. Environment, $172 million. Safer communities, this is a combination of prison space and some other space related to the sex offender treatment facilities. And then you'll see effective government and public services, $89 million. And this is a little bit of a catch-all for a number of other recommendations in the state government area that, for the most part, make up some of the asset preservation funds. Now I'll just kind of take each of those areas and each of those policy areas and give you a little bit of highlights.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Houseman.
Just one more clarification then, because sometimes we have one conversation in one committee, but it's not necessarily how you would measure it in our committee. In transportation, when we talked about how we were going to build roads the last time without raising taxes, and the question, we're going to bond in this way, and the question was, where's the debt service for that? And the department, MnDOT's response was, we're going to save in all of these other areas to pay for the debt service. Now, that may be the conversation we had in that committee, but is that reflected in any way in your, is that conversation reflected in your numbers, or do you, would you view that whole discussion in a different way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, I think that I'm not sure if you're asking a particular question. I think you're right when you say that the one way that we look at it is that the overall, the debt service for those, that bonding is out of the existing flow of revenues that come into the highway fund. So there weren't new dollars. There is some growth that is assumed, growth both in the way of federal highway dollars and growth just in added miles, that some of that is being paid, that is being dedicated towards the debt service, the added payments on that money that's available. I think that at the time the case was made that given the needs in the transportation area, and there was some rationalization given for the bonding that costs of projects were accelerating, and to be able to borrow the funds and pay for the projects, you save that inflationary cost increases in particular. But I think in the charts that you've seen here that summarize the total authorized bonding that's outstanding, that would include the highway funds, but you know, we again don't look at the debt service in the same way. I think it's useful to think about the overall debt and all of the sources of funding that go to repay the debt, regardless of the fund that it's from, when you're having discussions here. I'm really not sure if I answered your question. I think that there's different ways to look at it.
You sort of speak different languages in different committees when we're talking about the same issue.
Can you give us, or maybe this is a question better left for Mr. Sausen, but my understanding is there is at least a constitutional interpretation with regard to the use of GO bonds for trunk highway purposes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that question probably would be addressed by Mr. Sausen, but I can tell you that what we have had interpreted from our bond council is that we really can't use general obligation debt for trunk highway bonds. There are what generally, to kind of break down some of the transportation things, because you'll see a lot of transportation projects in the governor's recommendations here, and those are funded by transportation bonds, and they're usually for projects that are not on the trunk highway system. They're for local projects. We kind of make the distinction between the trunk highway fund and where we have authorized bonds in the past for the highway fund repaid by the gas tax, the state share of the gas tax and vehicle license fees, and the local roads that aren't eligible for state trunk highway bonding. Those are funded really with the general obligation behind that.
Members, I think that's a clarification that you want to note. We'll have Mr. Sausen go through that probably in some more detail, but for those of you who are looking for bridge replacements and other transportation improvements in your communities or around the state, remember you need to differentiate between what is going to be a trunk highway project from what is going to be a local project, or the delineation between the two, local share versus state share. So we'll, as I said, cover that in some greater detail when Mr. Sausen is here. But just remind your local communities, we had some discussion myself just last week about having difference of interpretation between what is local share and what is state trunk highway. So continue, if you would, then, Commissioner.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, this will take each of those areas and just give you a little bit of highlights or summarize what's in there. In the education area, the funding recommended by the governor for the MNSCU system, the state colleges and universities, is $88.6 million. For the U of M, $76.6 million. And I should probably just make a statement here a little bit about the distinction in these areas. For the higher ed projects, historically, we have kind of looked at anything that is a new project separate from the asset preservation kinds of taking care and maintaining existing facilities. We've looked at any new funds under a kind of user-financed formula where the state pays two-thirds of the debt service that you'll see in that general fund number, and where the institutions pay one-third of the debt service. Now, that is the case on the MNSCU system, but it's not the case on the U of M system here, because what the University of Minnesota has the ability to issue their own debt, and so their projects are only showing the state share, general fund share, so they are separately authorizing and issuing debt to cover what would be the one-third share of some of their new building projects here. So I just wanted to kind of hopefully clarify that as people are making comparisons here. For the Department of Education, the recommendation is 24.2. The biggest portion of this is a project for the Red Lake School District. For the Minnesota State Academies, these are the school buildings at Faribault. $4.3 million is primarily asset preservation. like the funding recommended for the Purpich Center for the Arts, $1.8 million. In the area of economic development, housing, and transportation, we've got $194 million as the total recommendation. Farm loans, this is the Rural Finance Administration, has historically been funded, authorized bonds. We consider these user finance bonds because they're loan repayments that finance the debt service here. Redevelopment and biotech grants, this is funding for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. In particular, the governor's had an interest in a number of what were submitted as local projects for biotech corridors in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. And he has added $10 million to the request for redevelopment funds that have historically been funded in this way. The $20 million recommendation for a joint facility that would house the biotech research facility that is part of the partnership between the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. There's $20 million recommended for permanent supportive housing, $10 million for the Cedar Avenue bus rapid transit, $38 million in local roads and bridges. You'll see that there's $10 million for local roads and $28 million for local bridges, and then $37.5 million for the North Star Commuter Rail Project.
Commissioner, excuse us again, Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you could speak to individual projects and where they might have come from. The question I have is relative to the Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transit. On Met Council's 2010 map, that didn't exist. It doesn't appear until 2025. And that's all based on need, when the ridership numbers show that a particular line would be needed. And that's how we set our priorities, so that we're assured that we fund the most needed projects. Do you have any sense how that suddenly advanced so many years ahead of other projects?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Houseman, I'm afraid that I can't speak to that. I wasn't aware that it was in a longer-term plan of the Met Council. I know that they had a request for, initially in the capital budget recommendation, there was also a request from Dakota County, and I think the two entities submitting the request were asked to get together and look at the project and to kind of agree to one request, because I think that there was a little bit of a difference in terms of what they were each requesting. But I was not aware, Representative Houseman, that it was in a longer-term plan. I think maybe the Met Council would need to speak to that.
It was not on the Met Council's 2010 plan, so that's for a later question.
Commissioner, the third project on the list, U of M Mayo Biotech, how come that is listed separately from the U of M? It is not the University of Minnesota going to be the fiscal agent, and is it not going to be a University of Minnesota facility?
Mr. Chairman, I think that there's been a lot of negotiating and working between the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic in the last year, working out the partnership arrangements. And I think that all parties agreed that it would be best to have this be like the existing operating budget appropriation that's appropriated to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. There's an appropriation of $2 million for this partnership between you and the Mayo Clinic. And I think that all of the parties that have been working on this project in the last year or so felt that it was probably made more sense to continue that same kind of arrangement rather than consider this a project that would be included in the University of Minnesota's request. It will be a building that's owned by it has public ownership, but it's considered state ownership, but operated by the partnership between the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic.
So, Commissioner, which agency is going to own the facility and be responsible for it?
Mr. Chairman, when you say which agency will own it, the governor's recommending that the appropriation be made to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. It would be a state-owned portion of a facility that would be basically operated under a lease arrangement with the partnership between the U and the Mayo Clinic. I guess we're considering it to be state ownership and not necessarily owned by an agency. Maybe I'm not picking up the subtlety of your question, Mr. Chairman.
Well, first of all, I believe we have a what I consider to be a significant lack of information about this particular request. Might be a wonderful concept, might be a great idea. Might further research at the Mayo Clinic, but we have rather stringent requirements on what general obligation bonds can be used for. To date, the committee has received no information that would indicate that the type of arrangement that's at least being talked about is doable. But beyond that, I mean, let's just, I guess this is the first time I've heard that this was not going to be a University of Minnesota, i.e. owned and operated type of facility, that we're planning on some other operating arrangement.
Mr. Chairman, the operations would be by the partnership between the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota, but the University of Minnesota would own this portion of the facility. And I would say, Mr. Chairman, that this is somewhat of a unique project, I would acknowledge, but there's been an awful lot of work put into really maximizing the public investment in this project. And so I would say that I'm sorry if you haven't gotten answers to your questions or much information about this, but we've been involved in a number of meetings, and the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic folks have been working diligently to put this project together that really maximizes the state investment here for the research and the facility that they've planned. And it would be adding to an existing Mayo Clinic facility. Earlier we were looking at a much more costly kind of facility, and I think that they've worked hard to kind of get the most for the state dollars by leveraging some of the infrastructure in an existing facility that the Mayo Clinic owns. And it as I say, Mr. Chairman, it's somewhat of a unique arrangement, but I know that there's a lot of information about it, and I would encourage you to have the university folks in to talk further about it. And I would, if any of them are here, I would encourage them to send you information, because there's a lot of information about this project.
Well, Commissioner, that's exactly the problem. I'm trying to define who is going to be the fiscal agent. Who do we talk to? Who does have the information? We have yet to receive any detailed information about what this project is, let alone how it's going to be financed. As you say, to my knowledge, we've never done I believe the term would be condominiumizing a facility before, and under general obligation bond, I don't see how. I mean, previously, when we've had this type of arrangement, my understanding is that the fiscal agent, whether it be the city of Minneapolis, whether it be Hennepin County, those types of fiscal agents, that the building had to be totally owned. If there were general obligation bonds sold, for the project, the building had to be totally owned. I think we had the recent example of the Children's Theater, that the facility had to be totally owned. So I guess I'm just looking for some clarification as to how the governor or the Mayo Clinic or the University of Minnesota or whomever believes that this is going to work, and whether or not the bond council will indeed concur with that concept.
Mr. Chairman, I think that you're asking a lot of good questions about the project. My understanding is that we have had an arrangement where there's been some condominiumization of a general obligation project in the past. But I guess to be clear, this would be owned by the University of Minnesota. The governor is just recommending that the funds be appropriated to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. But the U would actually own this. The Mayo Clinic would be basically building the building. The university would be funding to actually purchase the publicly owned share of the building. And Mr. Chairman, you're asking very good questions, and I'm assuming that you'll get a lot more information about this project.
Well, Commissioner, I guess the question is, who do we talk to? Do we talk to the University of Minnesota?
Yes.
Do we talk to the Department of Finance? Do we talk to Department of Economic Development?
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly, we've looked at, folks in our department have looked at the bonding questions that you're raising and the bond council questions about the somewhat unique arrangement here, and so we could certainly, Mr. Salzen and others can answer those questions. The University of Minnesota is prepared to talk to you about this project, as well as the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So I think, and the Mayo Clinic folks as well would be, any and all would be willing to talk with you, depending upon your questions, Mr. Chair. I think you could consider the, you mentioned the term fiscal agent, and this would actually be owned by the University of Minnesota, but I think that the governor's recommendation created to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. They would be able to respond to your questions regarding their role in the project and the oversight as well.
Then can you explain to me why we would, if the University of Minnesota is going to own this portion of the building, why would the funds be appropriated to the Department of Economic Development?
Mr. Chairman, I think that because of the unique arrangement in the partnership between the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic, that's where the funds had been appropriated for the operating budget, and I think all of the parties involved thought that that would be the best way to provide the right level of oversight rather than just appropriating the funds to the U. And it looks like I have some help. Okay. Mr. Chairman, the executive budget officer for the higher ed group, Heather Johnston, is here and can talk to you about how this arrangement will be made, because I may not have been correct when I talked about the appropriations.
Thank you. You just give us your name for the record,
Heather,
please.
Heather Johnston from the Department of Finance. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe our intent is, in the governor's bonding bill, would be to have an appropriation to the University of Minnesota. However, it would be found in the section for the Department of Employment and Economic Development, if you're talking about the facility specifically.
And again, I'm just trying, well, I won't belabor the point. Representative Mahoney, you were first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, today at the governor's news conference, it would seem that you could call the governor, because I believe this was the first announcement in his biotech initiative as one of his priorities out of the 35. This was one of the four or five that he announced, and at the same time announcing the collaboration on four different research projects with the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic, which would be pretty much run out of this particular facility. So it seems that the UN and Mayo would be using it, but I'm sure the governor could give you a lot of answers to that. But barring that, tomorrow at 3:15 over at the History Center, there's going to be a Bioscience 101 class, and you could get any number of answers to your questions, I'm sure, over there. And I'm just, as a member of that particular council, I'm extending a personal invitation, just like you extended a personal invitation to me to go tour the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I wanted to say that I appreciated that, and I enjoyed the tour a lot.
Good. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a little bit confused on this as far as a general obligation bond. I heard that we're going to give the monies to the DTED, and it's going to own the building, or whatever we call that agency now. It's, every governor has to change it. Some numbers that are some letters anyway, DD or whatever it is. But I heard that the university and Mayo were going to lease the building. And so I want to know, is then this a general obligation bond or is this a revenue bond?
No, Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, I understand where you're confused because I may have led to some of that. So let me just have Ms. Johnston respond to how this is going to work. I think the lease arrangement is more for kind of the ongoing programs that are in the facility.
Mr. Chair, Representative Silver, the University of Minnesota will own the facility. However, they will then lease the facility back to the Mayo Clinic in order to perform research functions that are covered under the partnership or support the work of the partnership.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if there's a lease arrangement, isn't that money involved in it? And is that lease just a buck, or is it enough to pay the bonds off? I mean, I don't...
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, it may be that when we say lease, it's you're thinking of a regular kind of lease where
that's what you usually
rent that pay. When we talk about
Okay,
we're looking for one of those sports facilities leases where you don't have to pay anything to play there.
Finance department world where we talk about the facilities being used for a public purpose, and we look at a lease agreement to for the facilities to be carrying out the public purpose. And so it's not a monetary lease arrangement. It's a use of the facility kind of arrangement.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and the other thing that I was so confused about was the ongoing operating expenses of the facility. Did I hear it right when say that that operating expenses is going to be appropriated to DED or whatever it is, whoever owns the building? I'd like to know where the operating expenses are coming from a public standpoint. Are anticipated to come.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, it's my understanding that the part of the use agreement for the use of the facility that would be established between the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Foundation would cover something like operating expenses. I believe it's my current understanding that the discussions have been that the Mayo Clinic would be paying for the operating expenses of the building through that sort of a lease arrangement. But I don't want to get too far out there, and I certainly can defer to folks from the Mayo Clinic or the University of Minnesota for correction on that. But it's my understanding that the operating expenses would be borne by.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, all of us, even the legislature, pays rent to the state of Minnesota. Are they going to, for maintenance and so forth of our buildings, is the Mayo Clinic going to pay rent for this? And then if they're not, then if what happens to the intellectual property that derived from a use of a facility such as this? Is that owned by the University of Minnesota? Is it owned by the state of Minnesota? Is it exclusively owned by Mayo Clinic?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, as soon as you mentioned the intellectual property, there's a whole the partnership is a complex arrangement to do research, and there's actually a lot of a federal legislation that deals with when there are federal grant funds involved, what happens to the intellectual property, and we just had some discussion about that the other day. But so there's lots of regulations that's involved, because what we're talking about is, you know, a combination of probably state funded and national national research funds that would kind of support the operations here. Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, I hope that I don't bring more confusion to this by saying this, but one of the things that we looked at when we were looking at this project overall is the way we typically look at higher ed projects with some user financing. What we looked at was the fact that the Mayo Clinic is providing support in the way of infrastructure in the balance of the building. So this is this addition on an existing building is much less expensive than it would be if they were to be building a freestanding building. And they had built this building like they have other buildings on the Rochester Mayo campus with added capacity to add on. So there is this capacity, and this is the plan and how we're kind of not thinking of this as we typically think of higher ed projects as user finance, but know that there's significant contributions that are being made to minimize the cost and to provide further leverage for the state funds that are in this project.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that. You have confused me a little bit more, but that's okay. I'm easily confused.
Members, if there are we're going to obviously need significantly more information about this project, hopefully we'll be able to find the right sources to get us that information.
And Mr. Chairman, can I also, for a future, have some kind of information on the difference between this particular biotech research facility and the biotech research facility that we just are building at the University of Minnesota, but close to the hospital, and what their missions are, their different missions.
Representative Bradley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had several hours of opportunities to sort of understand this, and I wouldn't even try to get into all the detail, but I would say that everything that you've talked about, I've heard sort of the specifics, even the intellectual property issues and the patents, if there are some monies, all that has been very carefully worked out. But I'm sure there are people, I know that Dr. Sarah and Hugh Smith from Mayo, that partnership would be happy, I'm sure, to come and share further details with you and with the committee as you'd like.
Commissioner, before we leave this topic, I just have one further request, and that is, as someone who likes to follow the money, can you give us an accounting of the $400,000 that was appropriated last year for the preliminary design for this facility? How much of that money has been expended and for what?
I don't need that, Mr. now. Mr. Chairman, we'll certainly get you that information.
Okay. Thank you. Now that we have digressed once again, we'll try to get you back to your presentation. Sorry.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, kind of continuing with the overview and just probably highlighting some of the larger projects here. This is just kind of the way that we've broken out the environmental projects. There's a whole host of projects on the list for a number of agencies, the DNR, the Board of Soil and Water Resources, the Public Facilities Authority, all relating to kind of environmental projects, and this is the way we've broken them down, protecting and restoring waters. This includes some of the money that would go for the wastewater infrastructure program that I'm sure you're all familiar with. Protecting and restoring lands, $18 million. Protecting and improving wildlife habitat, $24 million. Improvements to the state parks and trails, $7 million. Expanding and improving Minnesota forests and making them more productive. Revitalizing the zoo, we have grouped here in the environmental projects for $25 million. And then asset preservation type projects, primarily at the DNR for $18 million. Under the category of the safer communities, there's a few fairly large projects here. The first being the Faribault Correctional Facility expansion for nearly $75 million. Another project for corrections, the Stillwater facility, to add a 150-bed segregation unit for $19 million. The new planning, really, and design for new facilities for sex offender program at the St. Peter Regional Treatment Center, and then the asset preservation and repairs at various correctional facilities for $11 million.
Excuse me, Commissioner, when the governor made his announcement of his recommendations, again, something that was unknown to us prior to January 15th was the new facilities for sex offenders at St. Peter. When can we anticipate that we'll get information that tells us the specifics about the whys and the wherefores of this particular project?
Mr. Chairman, members, as you're pointing out, Mr. Chair, most of the requests were included as agencies prepared requests last summer. This is one that is a new item that kind of came up after some of the initiatives related to sex offenders and holding them longer in treatment facilities. And really the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services kind of looking at their capacity for the facilities and making an estimate of how many more of these folks would be held in programs and really needing to accelerate the plans at St. Peter. There were some plans to expand this facility out in the longer term plans, and this was accelerated as a result of the more recent efforts to hold sex offenders longer. And you'll see, Mr. Chairman, I think that the request that's included, there's a fair amount of detail about what the plans are here. This would be design funds for accelerating that. We'd be looking at getting construction funds in the 2006 session. And I think that's detailed in a little bit more in the request.
And we'll follow up then with corrections with regard to the program. I just, my understanding is that we still have empty bed space in that facility. So without knowing what the legislative outcome of any additional proposed sex offender incarceration or treatment, etc., how can we be appropriating money for design?
Mr. Chairman, I think
that... Or is somebody presuming that we're already going to do this even though we haven't done it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that this, as I said, this was in the plans, but out a little bit further in their strategic request. I think that there's some action that's currently underway that would lead us to some administrative action that's been taken that would lead us to the conclusion that there may be a lot more people, a lot more capacity is needed.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up to the chairman's question about St. Peter, now, in talking with, I will leave a commissioner unnamed at this point in time, because sometimes commissioners and the governor don't always go on the same road. This commissioner told me that there isn't a need at St. Peter at this time, and there are empty beds statewide that are ready for level 3 offenders. There's 70 in Walker, there's 60 or 70 in Wilmer, just to name two places. It's hard for me to look at putting $3 million in planning money for something that one commissioner tells me there's not a need for yet. There's still room there. and we have all the empty beds, and the commissioner did ask, do you want these people, and how soon can you take them? So maybe someone might want to go back to the drawing board on that one.
Mr. Chairman and Representative House, I'm surprised to hear what you're saying. I'm not aware of such capacity. I know that what we're talking about here is facilities for psychopathic personality offenders, which is a little bit more highly specialized kind of treatment that is required in order to constitutionally hold these people beyond their sentence. I would say that I'm not aware of the capacity elsewhere, and I certainly will raise this issue with a couple of the commissioners, even though you haven't named them, because certainly, you know, we are not looking to build facilities that aren't needed. I think that those of us that have been involved in the capital budget process here with the governor really assume that there was a pretty clearly demonstrated need here, but I certainly will follow up because I'm not aware of the capacity as you've described.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
House.
I will take a facility in my own district because I'm familiar with it. We have 70 plus beds right now that are fully secure, alarms, cameras, the whole nine yards. And some of the residents in Agua Ching right now, the new ones that you could send would be very, very tame compared to the ones that we have now. So saying that we need to have a facility that's more secure or has more talent in handling these people is not necessarily true. And I will quote Governor Pawlenty from the Bemidji paper, January 3rd, 2003, that using this facility with the Department of Corrections and civil commitment people would be a win-win-win situation for the state of Minnesota.
Now they're all winning.
Thank you. Part of your time.
Yeah.
School people.
Representative Keller.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, your question, Commissioner, I'm not sure I'm clear if the $3 million is for something that can then be tailored to what action the legislature may take during this session, or is based on current law then. And so I guess I would have a question about capacity, and I think that's the question you were trying to get at, whether we're looking at accelerating something that is based on current law as we sit here today, or whether we're going to be taking a longer-term view of this facility.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kelleher, I'm getting reinforcements to answer that question.
Reinforcements.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name is Jim Showalter. I'm from the Department of Finance. Thank you. My understanding of the situation is this. The project was originally included in the 2006 planning estimates, knowing that the population was going to continue to grow. Once committed into the psychopathic personality program, they tend to remain in that program. As a result, it's sort of an additive effect. As of fall, it was a fairly close estimate as to whether they were going to get through the current biennium with the existing capacity. Under current law, the number of commitments that were being made were higher than originally estimated. So as a result, that's what pushed that request into the 2004 capital budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelly.
So then we want to be clear then in terms of looking at this request is really under current population estimates, under current law, and where we sit today, not looking, not looking at what changes may happen, And as we have seen with the Ramsey County case and the jail, these things are tricky things to predict, but obviously there may be changes that then we want to, I mean, I guess being fiscally prudent here, you certainly don't want to build a facility that is outdated the moment that it opens. And I guess I raise that just for us to sort of bookmark for later on.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Sure, well, yes.
I want to clarify one point where I'm less certain, and that is the change in commitment policy or reference policy by the Department of Corrections to the county attorneys and how much that will impact the use or the projections of the uses of these beds. I can't speak to that specifically.
Thank you. If you want to stay, Representative Murphy, you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Sir, then where is the Phase 2 project on the Moose Lake Psychopathic Personality Facility?
I don't know.
And how did St. Peter, what phase is St. Peter in that we have this program there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not know the status of the Moose Lake, any expansion at Moose Lake. Would need to get back to you with information on that.
I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, I recall when the Moose Lake Psychopathic Personality Hospital was built to deal with the level 3 sex offenders, it was designed in such a way that the infrastructure is in place for additional pods to be added, so you don't have to have some of the basic infrastructure, and it was designed purposely for an expansion.
Commissioner, what is the 06 planning estimate for St. Peter facility?
Mr. Chairman, it's $39.6 million.
Thank you. Any further questions at this? Otherwise, Commissioner, we'll try to get back on course and back on schedule here.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members, this is sort of our catch-all category where we've got a number of projects, a large one for $15 million recommended for cooperative local facility grants. This is a new grant program that the governor is recommending to be available to provide incentives for communities to local units of government, cities or counties, to share some facilities and to provide some state funds requiring a local match, but to leverage local dollars and getting some changes made to kind of the provision of public service in a cooperative manner with local units of government.
Commissioner, excuse me, I just can't help but ask the question. Previous life, I was chair of the State Government Finance Committee and spent a considerable amount of time agonizing over a little entity called the Board of Government Innovation and Cooperation that I believe handed out state grants to accomplish what might be in the narrative here a similar type of task. I think we finally succeeded in actually eliminating that little program. The majority leader voted for that particular legislation. So can you tell me why we would want to recreate something that we endeavored for several years to try to eliminate in a bipartisan way, I might add, yes.
Mr. Chairman, this would be a program exclusively related to facilities, unlike the Board of Government Innovation. And this is basically to say that, you know, given some of the things that have occurred over the recent years with just actually last year with cuts to local government aid and cuts to local governments, that it's really this is a grant program that's out there to provide some incentives for local governments to cooperate, not so much cooperate, but actually to consolidate and to help them be a little bit more effective and maybe do some sharing of services. And kind of there's some guidelines laid out that talk about the fundamental change in how services are delivered between entities, whether this would be some of the things that I would consider to be eligible kinds of projects is several years ago we had a regional jail facility grant program, and you know those are places where there's a fair amount of pressure for local units of government, and so if there's opportunities for local units of government to come together and look at sharing facilities or consolidating some facilities, that's what the grant program is designed to do.
And what, well, I won't go any further into this at this point in time, but you can change the verbiage on the narrative, but sounds to me, as I said, exactly like the Board of Government Innovation and Cooperation in the grants to local units of government to achieve, in my estimation, what they were already supposed to do. But we'll leave this for this is going to be administered through the Department of Administration.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And who do we think in the Department of Administration has the knowledge and expertise to hand out tens of millions of dollars of grants to local units of government?
Mr. Chair, this is basically, again, to kind of make sure that there's an understanding of the distinction between this and the earlier program that is no longer around, is that this is strictly facilities. And, you know, obviously folks in the Department of Administration have a lot of experience with facilities and looking at facilities, and so it's a grant program that would really look at, you know, it's intended to be an incentive for local units to do things differently.
Representative Howes, you had a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually think the program would be a good pilot program. In fact, the Department of Corrections, until I think this week, had on their website that it would be a good idea for state government to join hands with local units of government to build regional jails throughout the state rather than one central prison. Cut transportation costs, it would cut costs of housing certain types of inmates. And this program, you had just mentioned that regional jails might be a way to do that. In fact, Cass County just voted this morning to spend $6 million, and the state of Minnesota, $6 million, and ask the state to join them in building a regional jail that would save space at Faribault and other places that are a little run down. So I think it's a great program, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative House. Representative Keller.
So, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I heard you say that because of the cuts during last session, what we're doing is we're basically making up for capacity that communities lost. Is that what you said?
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Kelleher, what I would say is that given, as the chairman asked the question, what's changed since we had this Board of Government Cooperation? And I think one of the things that's changed is that there have been some significant local aid cuts. And I wouldn't say that this is to make up for capacity, but it's really to, again, be this incentive program that's out there to say, if local units of government can kind of come together and talk about how they're going to fundamentally change things. You know, maybe it's they're going to eliminate some, share some positions and, or reduce the staffing in a way that between maybe several counties or cities, and a facility accommodates that. This is to be an incentive program to do that. And basically to really say that this is an effort to encourage and support and provide some incentives for the really changing the way some government services are delivered locally.
Mr. Chairman,
I
think there's probably some facilities that maybe lend themselves better than others to this sort of thing. I happen to grow up in a county that did a regional library system many years ago, I think in the late 1970s, and that fell apart last year. Maybe the year before. It was a bloody and awful fight between the counties who were in the affiliation together. They had gone and built a facility, they had shared resources, and suddenly what they found is that people didn't like driving 30 miles to the library once a week. It wasn't really all that interesting. So I guess I'd just say that we need to be very careful about what we're incenting here and what it does to communities.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of other things that are on this list in this category. The Buffalo Lake Maintenance Garage in repair as a result of a tornado that occurred there. $600,000. The Colin Powell Youth Leadership Center, $4.2 million of facility in Minneapolis. Roseau, some infrastructure repair and improvements related to floods in the Roseau area, $10 million. And then we've kind of lumped together here all of the asset preservation and repair projects for the state government agencies, $54.7 million. The next chart, Mr. Chairman, shows the
financing.
Excuse
me, one moment, Commissioner. Representative Erdahl, did you have a question that you wanted to?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you would indulge me just to back up a little bit, some of the economic development, housing, transportation, the $18 million in farm loans, is that a customary amount?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, yes, that is the RFA, and Mr. Merkin probably has the answer to the...
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the funding for that program has kind of come in fits and starts over the years, but let me rattle off sort of the dollar amounts of different years. $50 million was appropriated for this program in 1986, $41 million was appropriated in 1996, and $20 million in 2000, $15 million in 2002. So there's been a great deal of variability as to the amount that's been appropriated. We spent a great deal of time working with the folks at the Rural Finance Authority to try to get a sense on looking at the business needs that were out there and the sort of demands that were being placed on primarily the rural banks to participate in this program, how much state funding they would need to have, and we tried to match up that funding with that demand, and that got us to the $18 million number in the governor's recommendations.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does that indicate then that if it was $50,000,086, the usage has declined in the program over the years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I mean, remembering that there was a fairly significant gap in time between 86 and 96, so I think the thought is rather than waiting until the last minute to replenish the program, to try to do it on a more periodic basis. So over the past couple of years, really beginning in 2000 when we appropriated $20 million and then $15 million in 2002 and now $18 million in 2004, trying to get on a more stable funding plane. And again, we think that this is the amount that can actually be used, so we think it's properly sized.
Commissioner, with regard to the Colin Powell Youth Leadership Center, I believe that's a Hennepin County request. And
yes.
I was just wondering... recently, the city of Minneapolis and Hennepin County came together to propose that they could, I think, raise funds somewhere close to $200 million to build a ballpark. The governor considered possibly rethinking that. If they can come up with $200 million for a ballpark, they can't come up with several million dollars more to help fund the youth of Minneapolis and Hennepin County?
Um, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how to respond to your question, what kind of answer you're looking for there. But I
was just wondering maybe
that
what the governor had in terms of priorities here, in terms of, you know, whether it was a ballpark or whether it was youth or
I would say, Mr. Chair, that this recommendation from the governor for the Colin Powell Youth Leadership Center does include a expected match and a challenge to raise funds locally and privately. So may not be the ballpark, but there is expected to be a local contribution here.
We'll certainly ask Hennepin County and Minneapolis why they have a little difficulty coming up with this money when they can seem to readily find resources to build a ballpark. But why don't you finish up then, Commissioner?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, that next slide just shows the financing, the portion that's in general obligation bonds of the total project. The portion that's user financed, as we talked about, the RFA loans and some of the higher ed projects are user financed primarily. There's general fund dollars requested, recommended in here, primarily for relocation of a number of agencies as well as some administrative expenses for various programs. Trunk highway funds, $6.8 million. These are for a number of projects that the DOT, smaller capital projects for the DOT. And then there's $18.7 million in trunk highway bonds, and these are for a couple more larger building kinds of projects. Next, Mr. Chair, this is a chart that we put together that shows mainly in response to lots of questions that have been raised about where the projects are located that are included in the governor's recommendations. And you'll see that primarily a little over 60% are in greater Minnesota compared with projects in the metro area, just under 40%. And then I would also just in closing, make the pitch that we have lots of valuable information about these projects and lots of detailed information out on our website.
Representative Hausman.
I'm just going back to the previous one, I'm sort of surprised to see that because frequently I thought the criticism has been that bonding projects are too much focused in the metro area because, of course, that's the home state government and the University of Minnesota and all of, you know, huge population base. And so how did this happen?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hausman, I have been, you know, understanding the way people have these kinds of questions about the capital project. I'm always reluctant to think about the location of projects, and I will let you know that this didn't weigh heavily into the governor's recommendations. It's something that we did after the fact, but we pulled the information together because it's just been a chronic burning question from folks. I think that you should think about a couple of the bigger kinds of projects, like the obviously the Minsky campuses with a number of projects there that are located outside the metro area. The big prison project in Faribault. There are a number of things, and I would expect that when you do have major projects like a prison, it may tend to, over time, kind of skew the relationship and the location here. But I think that what we try to do is there's a number of projects that are considered to be statewide in nature, bridge projects, sewer projects, but primarily made an estimate based on historically where those projects have occurred. So we tried to kind of take the statewide programs and allocate based on history and some of what agencies may know for projects that are on the waiting list. And this is our best stab at estimating the location of the projects.
Commissioner, can you give us an indication as to when the governor's supplemental budget would be released?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The governor intends to make his supplemental budget recommendations after the February forecast, which will be coming out the 26th through the 27th of February, so that first week of March The governor will have his supplemental recommendations.
And just I'm a little curious as to the situation. Obviously, the reason that there's a statutory requirement for the governor's budget, capital budget recommendations, is because in the legislature we follow the process of these recommendations going to finance committees to ascertain not only the worth of and the value of the projects, but also the impacts on operating budgets. So can you give us an indication as to how the finance committees in the House are supposed to make those determinations when we don't know what the governor's supplemental budget recommendations may be, and I guess we also don't know where the additional debt service is going to come from to fund the governor's recommended level of bonding. So, got any ideas what we do for the next month while we're waiting for the governor to get his supplemental recommendation?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I recognize the problem in terms of timing. The governor has told us that he, for the most part, his recommendations that the added costs that are related to the bonding bill and to his bonding recommendations and the general fund expenses that are included in here, as well as some of his other initiatives, will be financed by reallocating things internally. And we're sort of working on that exercise now. At the same time that we're looking at just overall the general budget balancing initiatives that are needed to bring the budget back into balance. So, Mr. Chair, I apologize for the timing and recognize the challenge that it gives you in having committees give fair consideration to these recommendations and looking at operating budgets. But for the most part, what we're looking at is reallocating funds internally inside the budget to finance the debt service and the general funds that are in here.
Representative Hausman.
And just so that you know, Mr. Chair, that is the conversation we had last year, and I can tell you very specifically when we asked MnDOT what they were cutting, among those were striping on roadways, road maintenance like snow plowing. So it wasn't snowing then. And those kinds of answers didn't have quite the impact that they do now. So when I hear that we're going to look for debt service in existing budgets, we have to be very sure, have them sign on the dotted line about which those cuts are. So when we remember, when we find out later if there was an impact, we'll know it was promised us.
Commissioner, the other question would be with regard to the strategic scores. I appreciate the department's diligence in putting our strategic, or keeping the strategic scoring process in place. As we had discussions last year, I think that this is hopefully an important measure that legislators, committees, as we go through the process, will pay particular heed to. Guess I'm a little disappointed that it didn't seem the governor paid much heed to the strategic scoring process that you worked diligently to provide him. Can you give us some indication as to, for example, why the Minneapolis Veterans Home kitchen remodeling scoring 330 points on the strategic score, which the governor didn't include in his recommendations, yet when you have projects such as the Willow River Challenge Incarceration Program that scores 100, the governor funds. So, I know that the governor does, governors do what governors do, and you don't necessarily have a lot of control or input on that, but I would think that he maybe would have paid a little bit more heed to what the strategic scores on some of these, and obviously Willow River, while it might be a wonderful program, I'm sure was quite far down the list. I think it was on the bottom of the list of DOC's requests. So it has a low strategic score. It's low on DOC's list of priorities, yet the governor, as I said, obviously I know it's a rather small amount of money, but seems that some other things on the list received, again, Americans with Disabilities Act upgrades for military affairs. Those are primarily our state armories. Again, no the strategic score of 350, no appropriate, no recommendation, or $0 recommendation from the governor.
Mr. Chairman, I'll take a stab at that one. I think what you need to do on the military affairs request is take a look at the details of the governor's recommendations. He funded some general asset recommended funding for general asset preservation requests that were higher ranked by that particular organization, and thought that it would be more appropriate to suggest that rather than splitting hairs for asset preservation and having different versions of asset preservation requests, to say that those portions of ADA accessibility improvements perhaps should compete with the general asset preservation projects, and the agency should find ways to accommodate the highest priority accessibility needs within their general asset preservation funding.
Well, we can go back to the example then of the Minneapolis Veterans Home. The committee did take time to have a site visit to that facility. I mean, again, I'm not necessarily trying to pick out project by project, and I would not in any way say that obviously the governor is going to follow a line for line strategic score, but I guess I'm still a little surprised by some of the very low strategic scores that the governor chooses to fund when, again, under, I think, the first item that you mentioned was the recognizes fiscal constraints on debt service and operating budgets.
Mr. Chairman, if I might kind of take a stab at that, I think that the strategic scoring is an important consideration and a piece of information to help in the decision-making process, and I think that for the most part the governor kind of followed along with the priorities and the strategic scoring, and I think that we have should feel responsible to let you know where there's been something that was deviated and why that is, and make the case. And I know that specifically for the corrections request for the challenge incarceration program, this was a lower priority item and a lower score. And the governor looked at the project, though, and said, given where we're at with the cost to add capacity to our corrections facilities and what it costs us to add beds, here's a relatively inexpensive way to add some capacity in the correctional in an area that's fairly effective. And so I think that he was very interested in this project because of the low cost that it was to add some capacity to the correctional system, where we have a lot of pressing needs overall.
And he didn't feel that the Department of Corrections could come up with $350,000 out of their operating funds.
They were cut so bad.
Representative Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, I actually am responding to something that you said earlier, and I just want to know where the committee stands in relationship to the stadium question, because we often have had some interests that are aligned on that issue. So I'm a bit concerned, and I only missed, I think, 15 minutes at the beginning of the meeting, but when you singled out a project that happens to be in the city of Minneapolis over the stadium issue, and I guess what I'm concerned about is, in the 6 years I've been here now, that issue has never really moved forward, the stadium issue. And in the last 2 years before that, 8 years, it's never really moved forward. So I would hope that we are careful, at least, about mixing those issues for the communities that may have bonding requests before you. I mean, if we're going to apply that standard, then we must apply it to Anoka County for the Viking Stadium. We must apply it to St. Paul in because they are a possible site for a twin stadium. And we must apply it to Minneapolis. But I would argue to you that we maybe should just, if we're going to see that issue for what it is, and not see that issue in relationship to some of these other issues. And in fact, that issue, I believe, is a Hennepin County issue and not a Minneapolis-sponsored issue, but maybe we're splitting hairs about that in terms of the way that our spreadsheet reads out here in terms of counties. But I do think we need to be careful about that because that issue hasn't moved forward. And if we're going to color our bonding bill by the fictional issue of the stadium, as many people see it, then we're going to have a very different product because that would say that all three of those communities are maybe going to be penalized by that standard. So I hope you'll clarify that for us as we move forward.
I'll be happy to clarify it right now. I mean, Hennepin County comes forward with a request of state GO bonds, $4.2 million, and then several months later comes forward and says that Hennepin County, in concert with Minneapolis, can come up with, I think it was, I don't know the, let's just say, tens of millions of dollars in revenues to fund the ballpark. I just, as I said, we'll put that issue to the Hennepin County Board with regard to their request. But I think it's very simple. Where are the priorities of Hennepin County? They come to us and ask us for money for this facility. Nothing against the facility. Again, the committee did take a visit to the facility, and we've talked about the benefits of the project. I guess, as I said, I'm talking about Hennepin County in what their priorities are.
Mr. Chairman, I hope we'll just talk about everyone's priorities in this deal then.
Boy, I hope so. Anyway, Commissioner, one final question, and that is I've heard the governor on numerous occasions now talk about the quality of life. In fact, last night at a dinner, he was asking members of the audience why they lived in Minnesota. I thought a rather dangerous question to ask, but can you give me some idea of how the Department of Finance actually quantified the quality of life as you went through these projects? As I said, the governor seems to be touting quality of life in Minnesota and somehow relating that to our capital investments, and that, i.e., if we build things, somehow that's going to improve the quality of life in Minnesota. Is there a way to quantify that in this process? Or was that included in the strategic scoring?
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall a category of strategic score that kind of gets at that very directly, but I'll tell you a couple of the conversations that during the course of developing the governor's recommendations, some of the conversations in particular as we were talking about the environmental projects and the ones where we talk about related to kind of clean water kinds of initiatives, is that the discussion has basically been, this is the waters and the lakes are a resource, and the responsibility that we have to preserve that resource and enhance them, the waters, for recreation or other longer term kinds of things. And the governor felt kind of strongly and talked about the parks and trails as being amenities. So the combination of taking care of what we have, those things that are clearly resources because of our state and what we have, as well as some of the facilities that newer facilities that are included in here.
I'm just one of those kind of analytical people that likes to quantify things a little bit more objectively than subjectively. Committee members, if there are no further questions for the commissioner.
I just had...
Representative Murphy, certainly.
Mr. Chair, I just have one because there's been a and I don't know, you might not want to answer, but I'm just kind of curious of how much of the governor's budget was prepared with the new commissioner, and how much was with the old commissioner and with Commissioner Weaver, or, I mean, you know, that...
Yeah, Chief of Staff Weaver, yes.
Like, was two-thirds of it done in November and one-third done in December, or...
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I think that